whoever's knocking at the door, come on in already. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm David Lazarus, sitting in all this week for Larry Mantle. Well, the drip, drip, drip of information about the Nixon administration continues. More than 150 hours of tape and about 30,000 pages of documents just released from the Nixon administration. No real smoking guns, apparently, but yet another window on this most controversial and in many ways pivotal of administrations. And, you know, it's hard in many ways to, in fact, pick out what's on the tapes. There's a lot of profanity. There's a lot of things that some people would find objectionable. For instance, let's get a little taste of them. Here is an audio clip of Nixon speaking with Reverend Billy Graham about Jewish opposition to evangelical outreach efforts.
Well, the Israelis, you see, what they do with a thing like this is they lose all of the support that they have in the world, you know.
That's right.
We're their only friends anyway, you know. No other country is their friend anymore. And now this just raises the... Oh, it's just terrible. What'll happen out of this if they don't, you know... What I really think is that deep down in this country there is a lot of anti-Semitism, and all this is going to do is stir it up.
It's right under the surface.
And oh, boy.
Right to the top.
That's right.
All right, that's just a little taste of some of these new tapes that have come out from the Nixon administration. And to tell us a little more about what's there and why it takes so long to get these glimpses of executive prerogative, we're joined by Luke Nichter. He's a Nixon historian at Texas A&M University, whose website, nixontapes.org, specializes in these sorts of recordings. Mr. Nichter, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So when you listened to these tapes, what was your takeaway?
Well, you know, there have been so many Nixon records released in the past few years that, you know, in the midst of what has sort of become our Nixon fatigue, it would be easy to miss the real importance of both the document and tape releases yesterday. You know, for example, for the first time, we have the Nixon tapes, the recorded conversations related to the end of the Vietnam War and the draft. I mean, talk about two issues that affected a generation of young Americans. But also of importance, other issues that are captured on the Nixon taping system include, as you know, commentary on Roe v. Wade, which has made headlines lately. Also, the conviction of the Watergate burglars toward the end of January. So beginning with this tape release, we will see more and more with the next tape releases. The management of Watergate is beginning to occupy a small but growing role in day-to-day policymaking in the White House.
And just to give people an idea of what we're talking about, when President, former President Nixon did comment on Roe v. Wade on January 23, 1973, when the Supreme Court struck down the abortion laws. He said that greater access to abortion would foster permissiveness. He said it can break up the family. But Nixon also said he sees a need for abortion in some cases. And the quote is, quote, "There are times when an abortion is necessary. I know that. When you have a black and a white or a rape." Okay, so Mr. Nichter, I mean, is this a new Nixon we're seeing here, or is this the Nixon that we've seen in other tapes?
You know, I did some thinking about this, and I think in some ways it's new, but in some ways it's also continuity. For example, you know, we have to remember the times. You know, this is someone who lived half of his life, you know, before 1960 civil rights legislation. So I think he's someone of his time, certainly not views that would be considered appropriate today, but I think we have to keep in the context he was born before World War I, so I think we have to keep that in mind. But certainly there are lots of new details which also add to our understanding of his character as well.
But there's a coarseness to much of what has come out in these and other tapes that, well, it reflects rather poorly on Nixon.
Yeah, I mean, it just depends. You know, the one issue that sticks out to me, for example, in terms of the Vietnam Peace Agreement, we see in these tapes three distinct Richard Nixons. This is remarkable. This kind of story would never appear on the textual records that just came out. For example, publicly, he was very confident in the peace agreement. In semi-private occasions, such as in the White House meeting with perhaps cabinet officials or congressional leaders, he was less confident, but privately, he often had no confidence at all that the agreement would hold.
All right, let's get another little taste of these things. Here's Nixon speaking with his aide, Charles Colson, about Nguyen Van Thieu, the president of South Vietnam.
Listen, Chuck, as I told Haldeman, your job is to see that, by God, we put it to him. Assuming it works out. It's going to work out one way or the other. If two doesn't go, that isn't too bad either.
No, it isn't.
We go ahead, make our deal,
sure,
and we sink two, and everybody says, thank God he was a tough son of a bitch on both sides, the hell of him.
That's right.
All All right. So Luke Nichter of Texas A&M University. That's Richard Nixon essentially setting up the head of South Vietnam for an armistice that almost certainly was bound to fail.
I think what we see here is Nixon acting in a moment of desperation. I mean, this is a peace agreement that has gone on for, this is now 1973, so it's gone on Nixon's first 4 years in office. This is a peace negotiations process that has taken the administration to the emotional brink. And this is Nixon in a moment of desperation, getting out of the war, whatever it takes, even if it the terms are not agreeable to South Vietnamese President Thieu. And Nixon also setting up Colson, saying, look, you've been reserved so far in our criticism of the opposition to the war, because after all, it's difficult to criticize them because we don't have an agreement yet. But as soon as we do have an agreement, you're to go after them.
I'm going to open up the phone lines right now. Your comments and questions about the Nixon tapes, the documents, and what Mr. Nichter referred to as Nixon fatigue are very welcome. 866-893-5722 or 866-893-KPCC. You can also join us online at kpcc.org. Just click through to the Air Talk page. Our guest is Luke Nichter. He's a Nixon historian at Texas A&M University, and he operates a website called nixontapes.org. And Mr. Nichter, I want to just kind of step back for just a moment and look at the drip, drip, drip of these releases over many decades. And what does that serve? What purpose is there in all of these things coming out over such long periods of time? And I expand that to the thinking of, well, when will we ever learn about, say, the Reagan administration or the Bush administration, the second one, the most recent one? Will my great-grandchildren be getting tapes from the Bush administration decades from now?
Those are great questions. I think on your very last point, I don't think any president will have tapes again. I think just about all of them have learned the lesson from the Nixon years, although we could be surprised. But as far as why it takes so long, you know, historians are long acquainted with the idea that they do the mopping up job of history. You know, journalists write the first draft of history, political scientists write the second draft, and historians come along at the very end. And historians kind of operate by a rule we call the 30-year rule, that as far as sensitive or classified, especially foreign policy-related government records, they tend to not come out until about plus or minus 30 years later. So in other words, if you want those real dirty details on, say, the intelligence information leading up to the most recent Persian Gulf War, it probably will take 3 decades. So the answer is, 30 years. I started this research about 2004. You subtract 30 years off the clock, and Nixon was brand new. I mean, it was 30 years old for everybody else, but it's brand new for historians.
But in the case of Nixon, you're vetting actual sheets of paper. You're listening to actual audio tapes. In the case of, say, the Bush administration, well, much of these records is digital. You've got a lot of emails. You've got a lot of other things along the way. What purpose is served by a time span of that long?
Well, first of all, it does take a while also because of the volume of materials. I mean, in the Nixon years, we're talking about, at least take just the presidential recordings alone, the tapes. 3,700 hours of tapes is a mind-boggling number of recordings. After the disclosure of the Nixon tapes during the Watergate trials, we also learned that presidents back to FDR also taped, but Nixon taped more than all of them combined. So we are talking about a massive quantity. The National Archives, which is the custodian for all of these records, presidential records, estimated in the early 80s that it took about 100 hours of staff time to process 1 hour of tape. So this is a massive, taxpayer-funded process, and they have to get it right. So they do take some time to be very meticulous about the details.
All right. Well, speaking of the National Archives, I want to bring in Timothy Naftali. He's director of the Richard Nixon Presidential Library and Museum, and he's the new guard there. He's the guy who comes from the National Archives as opposed to the Nixon Foundation. Mr. Naftali, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, David.
Very interesting set to at the Nixon Presidential Library and Museum the other day. $150,000 in funding got yanked away.
Well, what happens is that people don't know this probably, but when the National Archives takes over a library, the U.S. government funds our salaries, they fund overhead, but the U.S. government doesn't fund programming. These libraries are supposed to be private public partnerships, and it is assumed that the private foundation, whose president's name adorns the door, over the door, will provide some funding. In the case of our relationship with the Nixon Foundation, despite the fact that when I was appointed, I made it clear that this would be a nonpartisan library, and the foundation understood that at the time. They have decided to oppose our efforts to make the library nonpartisan and have withdrawn support for really nonpolitical exhibits that they had once been willing to sanction. So we're just going ahead anyway.
And this most recent fracas stemmed from what?
Well, in this case, it's actually been a long process. But the apex came when I invited John Dean to speak about a reissue of his book, Blind Ambition. But the Dean event was just one event that they opposed. They opposed Richard Benveniste coming to speak of his memoir on Watergate and 9/11. This is a man who was one of the commissioners of the 9/11 commission. He was also an assistant special prosecutor at the time of Watergate. He's had a long and distinguished career, and they didn't want him to come either. So the issue really is whether taxpayers should pay for libraries where there is a list of those who may not speak, and of course I oppose that.
When you arrived at the Nixon Museum and Library, did you find more an institution of propaganda than an institution of history?
I have been very careful not to characterize what I found.
But you can change that today.
To be fair, they were running a private museum. They had every right to run it. It was paid for by the friends of President Nixon. The argument I'm making is that if the federal government is spending money on an institution, and school kids in particular are coming through it, then the federal government has an obligation to ensure that there is a nonpartisan historical presentation, because we cannot afford in the United States to spend money on historical propaganda. We need citizens who know about the past, who can understand the role that institutions play. What we need is civic literacy, not civic religion.
Well, among other things, you've substantially changed the Watergate exhibit at the library. In what ways is it different now?
Well, it's not fully completed. Our first exhibits are up. We have an exhibit on the 18.5-minute gap, which leaves it to the visitor to try to, we present the material, the evidence of what we know about it and what we don't know, and leave it to the visitor to conclude what she wants to conclude. We also have an exhibit about where all the tapes were, all the microphones were in the rooms where President Nixon taped, and we're completing a multimedia interactive kiosk that takes you through the entire story of the events that we all know as Watergate. Because Watergate, of course, was not just the Sagan break-in, it was the break-in into Dr. Fielding's office, it was the warrantless wiretapping, it was the dirty tricks. All of those are part of the story, and you can't really have a federal museum that talks about Watergate that doesn't present the full story. I mean, if you did, I think a lot of taxpayers would feel their money is being misspent.
Well, what's been the reaction of the Nixon Foundation to this?
To what we put up so far? Well, I leave it to them to react. I mean, they have a blog, and they talk to the media. We're pressing forward. This is what we said we would do. Under the agreement, the National Archives is responsible for all presentations in the museum, and I do consult with them. I certainly don't want to make any historical errors, but in the final analysis, at the end, it's our decision what goes in there.
I'd like to bring back Luke Nichter. He's a Nixon historian at Texas A&M University. And, Mr. Nichter, it seems as if there is an ongoing struggle for control of history.
You know, there is. And I think we need to bring some perspective into a little bit, too. I mean, there are also four other living presidents or their heirs living now, at least. So I think what Tim's describing, I think, is a balance that has to be struck at those presidential libraries, too. I mean, while the family and the heirs are alive, you do want to be respectful in the exhibits, the materials, the speakers, but you also have to be honest to history. And at times there's not a problem, but other times there are these conflicts that Tim's speaking about. So these are challenges that I think other presidential libraries are also going through.
If I may add one thing, you know, Luke and I are trained historians, and we know, and we both, I'm not currently teaching, but Luke is, we both know that the students we get in college have not studied the 70s. If you ask high school age kids in this country whether they've studied the 70s, you will find more often than not that they have never studied the 70s, which means they don't know about Watergate, which means that there are kids in college that if they do not take an American history course may never learn about that constitutional challenge.
And yet I have a degree in history, and I found that recent history is virtually unattainable in many campus settings. It's all about what we would refer to as ancient history.
You know, I mean, when we had this debate over warrantless wiretapping in 2005, it continued, but it really was at its peak after those New York Times articles. Most people, I happen to study this as part of what I, you know, what I did before, how I cut my teeth in this business, but most people didn't know the context to why you had a FISA and why these issues were had been ripe in the 70s. And I think that's a shame. And if the federal government can play a role in just putting the evidence out, I think, as Duke mentioned, as Luke mentioned, I mean, there's always going to be a debate. But if we could just have the evidence out there and let people make up their own minds, I think we're doing a public service.
Well, let me ask you both, starting with Mr. Nichter, will we ever know the real Richard Nixon?
Oh, wow. You know, I think there's probably been over 1,000 books or articles written about Richard Nixon easily, or Henry Kissinger or the administration. And so many authors struggle with really defining who the human being was, you know, behind the skin. And it's such a there's so many layers, there's so many paradoxes. I think many authors do get it wrong, unfortunately. And I'm not saying that I get it right, but I mean, he's really a truly unusual person. He's a person that you're sort of repulsed by and attracted to all at the same time.
Mr. Naftali?
Well, I'm going to allow my colleagues who are active historians make up their minds. I think what's exciting, though, is the amount of materials that we're working hard to process and get out. There are another 700 hours of tape to come. We're working as fast as we can to get them out so they don't come out in dribs and drabs.
All right, Luke Nichter and Timothy Naftali, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. I'm David Lazarus, in for Larry Mantle. I'll be back again tomorrow. Looking forward to that. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio.